genial climate, with all the year mild and spring-like. The average annual temperature is 19.3 degrees centigrade. As a result, the province is a kingdom of fauna and flora, with a variety of rare animals and birds, such as elephants, snub-nosed monkeys, and peacocks, and tens of thousands of varieties of plants. Rich local or special products. They include fine tobacco, tea, ham, medicinal herbs, marble handicraft articles, and the Yunnan Bai Yao, a medicine for hemorrhaging and wounds. Folk customs. Inhabited by 24 minorities, Yunnan has many national folk customs, festivals, traditions, dances, costumes, and houses that are of great interest. For instance, the water splashing festival in April, with dragon boat regatta, of the Dai people in Sichuangbanna, and the torch festival in July, of a few minorities, including the Yis, Bais, and Sanis, are two of the most famous annual celebrations. With such a variety of things to see in Yunnan, tourist parties with special purposes have been organized. For instance, there are parties to see the azalea blooms of all types in various places. Mountain climbing. The folk customs of the minorities. Or walking tours through scenic routes. However, according to the Deputy Director of Kunming Tourism Bureau, Peng Shaoxi, there are hindrances to Yunnan's tourism. Woefully inadequate transportation facilities. Foreign tourists often find it hard to get into Yunnan, while those who are leaving are often stranded at Kunming's airport for lack of flights. It often takes 10 days to finish a trip in Sichuangbanna, too long for most tourists.
5. Good impression about China. Editor. Last May, my wife and I visited Beijing, the capital of your beautiful country, and attended the 4th World Conference on Continuing Engineering Education. We received a warm welcome everywhere we went. Combining business and pleasure, we visited many areas of the city and met quite a few citizens from all walks of life. From our visit, we know that China is a great country. We know that the Chinese people are warm and friendly. We know that Beijing is much safer than most American cities. We have told all our friends about our wonderful experiences. In a few years, we hope to return to China and teach for a semester. Unfortunately, the American people do not see your country as we did. Our television media does not convey the warm hospitality of the people. Our newspapers do not report the steady modernization of the past 10 years, nor do they mention the continuing increase in the standard of living. Sad to say, the American public thinks of China as it was 40 years ago. The solution to my country's mistaken impressions about China is simple, but it will take time. Continue our open-door relations. Continue our economic trade. Most especially, encourage Americans to visit China and experience her friendship and charm. Christopher J. Smith, Westville, USA.
6. Fond memories of a trip to India. At least twice I thought about giving up my trip to attend a conference on counseling in India last month. The first time was when it seemed I could never, ever get my visa to India. The second time was after I had the visa and went to buy my plane ticket. There I learned the ticket I had booked was not available because of a computer error. But I persevered, and I am glad, because the trip turned out to be nice, although it was too short for me to see much of India. From the moment we landed at Bombay Airport, we three women from Beijing were surrounded by the differences in language, people, food, scenes, and even traffic. One drives on the right side of the road in China, but on the left side in India. It was a completely strange place, but I felt easy and safe. The Indians we met were so friendly that when each of the participants to the conference was invited to say one thing about the meeting, I said, "I am glad to have this chance to know you beautiful Indian women and handsome Indian men." I would not forget the guard at the exit of the international airport in Bombay, who kindly insisted that we wait in seats usually reserved for the guards, because the people who were supposed to meet us failed to show up as expected. And when I wanted to make a phone call to get somebody to pick us up, and could get no coins anywhere, another guard took me to a phone reserved for airport staff. It could be a very frustrating experience to miss one's flight and arrive at the destination 8 hours later than planned, which is what happened to us after the conference. But it turned out somehow not as frustrating as it might have been. We were at the Coimbatore Airport on our way back to Bombay after the conference, and we were to leave for home from Bombay the next evening. We were told that we could not take the 10 a.m. flight as we had planned, because our tickets had not been confirmed properly, and there were no seats available. But we were told that we could be in Bombay that evening if we took a flight to a nearby airport in Bangalore and go from there to Bombay. We were killing time by measuring the airport's modest waiting room when an airport officer stopped in front of us, introduced himself as the officer on duty at the airport, and assured us that there would be no problem, that things would be straightened out for us, and everything would be all right. In half an hour, we had our new tickets in our hands. Yet, before long, we were called to the ticket counter and informed that we would not be able to catch our connection flight at the Bangalore airport because the flight from Coimbatore would be 1 hour late, and we would have to take the next flight leaving Bangalore and arriving in Bombay at 8 p.m. 1 hour later, when I was thinking how unlucky we were that day, we were lining up for the security check. A young woman in airport uniform approached us and said, "We are so sorry that we failed to arrange your morning flight. We did try, but..." You don't hear such words very often when you are upset by travel problems in China, even when you are the victims of the travel service's mistakes. Her words swept away my bitter feelings at having to spend the whole day at airports while we might have been exploring Bombay for the afternoon. And that was one of the several moments when I could not help but fall in love with the Indian people. I fell in love with them earlier, when a taxi driver, a quiet old man, followed me and gave me his drinking water to wash my mouth when I got sick halfway to the conference place. I fell in love with them when the children at the school close to the conference building passed by and greeted us with hello and morning, with smiles and a little shyness. I fell in love with them when the college students in Bombay, sitting on steps at the gate, waved to us cheerfully across the street. Yes, I would love to visit India again. I want to see the protected forests and the flowers blooming everywhere, and the charming, elegant women in colourful saris again, and of course, the India Airlines staff members too. And I want to see no beggars along the streets, no slums alongside the beautiful beach in Bombay, no school-age boys serving at the tables in restaurants, to hear no new stories about young wives who are burnt to death because the dowry from their parents failed to satisfy the husband's families. And I hope India will see more Chinese visitors in the near future, and China see more Indian visitors too.
Lesson 13. Work to live, or live to work. Text. What does work mean to people? A group of people from different walks of life are being interviewed about what role work plays in their lives. Their attitudes, as we can see, vary.
Mr. Fisher, you are an accountant and earn a good enough salary to enable you to live comfortably. What does your work mean to you?
I regard it as a means to an end. Basically, I'm a family man, and as long as I have a job which enables me to earn enough money to live well, I'm happy. I find a comfortable life compensates for the fact that I have a routine life and 3 weeks' holiday per year.
So in fact, you don't really mind what you do for a living?
I didn't say that. I wouldn't want to be a manual worker, for instance. I enjoy my profession up to a point, but it certainly doesn't rule my life. As soon as I get home, I forget about the office. I suppose you could say I work to live.
Miss Burns, as a schoolteacher in a working-class area of London, how do you feel about Mr. Fisher's attitude towards his work? Personally, I couldn't work to live. I must enjoy whatever I do, even if the salary is low. Otherwise, I feel it isn't worth doing.
Of course, Miss Burns. You do have long holidays, which must be a great compensation. Also, you aren't married, and therefore have no family responsibilities.
Being single has nothing to do with it. Even if I were married, I'd still have to have a fulfilling profession. In other words, Miss Burns, work plays one of the most important roles in your life. Definitely. It gives me the mental satisfaction I need, and a role in society. Contrary to Mr. Fisher, I can say that I live to work. Of course, Mr. Fisher is employed by a company, and Miss Burns by a school, and therefore both have a certain amount of guaranteed security. Mr. Evans' history is unusual. At the age of 40, he gave up a good job in industry to do what he had always wanted to do, become a journalist and photographer. He's self-employed and does freelance work. Mr. Evans, do you have any regrets?
Yes, one. That is, that I didn't resign from my other job when I was younger.
What made you leave the business world?
Well, although I had a good salary and a job which involved a lot of travelling abroad, I always felt I was in the wrong job. I felt tense all the time, and I suddenly realized that, in spite of security and what seemed to my friends to be an exciting job, I'd stopped enjoying simple but important things. Don't you consider your choice rather selfish? What about your wife and family? They're delighted. They see the change in me, find me more relaxed, and therefore my relationship with my wife and family has improved, because I'm not frustrated anymore. It's because I'm doing what I want to do.
Do you work as hard as before?
Yes, even harder. But I'm self-disciplined, and I find that working hard for a few hours gives me time to play hard, too. I have a more balanced life.
So, in fact, you too have a routine life?
Of course. Everything becomes routine after a while. But it's up to us to make that routine a creative experience.
Oh, yes, I do agree.
And we mustn't forget that all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy.
2. Read. Read the following passages. Underline the important viewpoints while reading. 1. Why work?
Michael, do you go out to work? Not regularly. No, I used to. I used to have a job in a publishing company, but I decided it wasn't really what I wanted to do, and that what I wanted to do wouldn't earn me much money. So I gave up working, and luckily I had a private income from my family to support me, and now I do the things I want to do. Some of them get paid, like lecturing and teaching, and others don't. What are the advantages of not having to go to work from 9 till 5? Ah, there are two advantages, really. One is that if you feel tired, you don't have to get up, and the other is that you can spend your time doing things you want to do, rather than being forced to do the same thing all the time. But surely, that's in a sense very self-indulgent and very lucky, because most of us have to go out and earn our livings. Do you feel justified in having this privileged position? Yes, because I think I use it well. I do things which I think are useful to people and the community, and which I enjoy doing. Joan, do you think that in order to lead a balanced life, people need some form of work?
Yes, I do. But I think it's equally important that their attitude to work, should be positive. If one is going to look on work as drudgery, something that one does so that one will enjoy one's leisure or whatever comes after it, then I don't think there can be very much satisfaction in it. But it seems to me that whatever work one is actually doing can become creative. And I think that this is what we all need to feel, that we are creating something, in the same way that even when a mother cooks a meal, she is creating, in her own way, something which is very necessary to her family.
Two. What is the value of work? Chris, what do you think the value of work is?
Well, I think it, in our present-day society, for most people, work has very little value at all. Most of us go out to work for about 8 to 9 hours of our working day. We do things which are either totally futile and totally useless, or have very little justification whatsoever. And for most of us, the only reason for working is that we need to keep ourselves alive, to pay for somewhere to live, to pay to feed our children. But surely, people wouldn't know what to do if they didn't have to go to work. Well, again, this raises the sort of two main aspects of work. That one, should we think of work only as a sort of breadwinning process, and this is very much the role it has in current society, or should we take a much wider perspective on work and think of all the possible sort of activities that human beings could be doing during the day? I think the sort of distinction currently is between, say, someone who works in a car factory and who produces cars which are just adding to pollution, to overconsumption of vital resources, who is doing something which is very harmful both to our environment and to probably society. To contrast his work with someone perhaps like a doctor, who I think in any society could be justified as doing a very valuable job, and one which, incidentally, is satisfying to the person who is doing it. What do you do? Is your job just a breadwinning process, or do you get some satisfaction out of doing it?
Well, in the job I do, I find that most of the satisfaction is a mental one. It's coming to grips with the problems of my subject and with the problems of teaching in the university. Clearly, this is the type of satisfaction that most people doing what we call in England white-collar jobs tend to look for and tend to appreciate in their jobs. This is quite different from the sort of craftsman who is either working with his hands or with his skills on a machine, or from people, perhaps, who are using artistic skills, which are of a quite different character. Certainly, it's becoming a phenomena that people who do white-collar jobs during the day, who work with their minds to some extent, although many white-collar jobs now are becoming very mindless. People who work on computers, people who are office clerks, bank employees, these people have fairly soul-destroying jobs, which nevertheless don't involve much physical effort, that they tend to come home and do do-it-yourself activities at home. They make cupboards, paint their houses, repair their cars, which somehow provide the sort of physical job satisfaction that they're denied in their working day.
3. The worst job. The worst job I ever had was as a waitress at a rest stop on the New Jersey Turnpike the summer I was 18. Everyone who passed through the place wanted their food now, and many of them seemed to think that tipping was a nice idea in theory, but not in practice. The pace was manic, and I had to wear a hairnet and white Oxfords. Most of the time, I arrived at work crying and drove home crying. The only good thing I can say about the experience is that it left me with the most profound respect for people who wait tables, and with a pronounced tendency to overtip. I had other jobs, before and after that one. I stuffed jelly doughnuts at a bakery in a bad neighborhood. I called people who were behind on their bills and ordered them to pay up. I was good at doughnuts and bad at threats. After that, I had jobs in the newspaper business only, so I never felt that I had a bad job again. I did not particularly care for working night rewrite on New Year's Eve, but I imagine that makes me just about average.
4. What do you do, Daddy? A young boy asks his father, "What do you do, Daddy?" Here is how the father might answer. I struggle with crowds, traffic jams, and parking problems for about an hour. I talk a great deal on the telephone to people I hardly know. I dictate to a secretary and then proofread what she types. I have all sorts of meetings with people I don't know very well or like very much. I eat lunch in a big hurry and can't taste or remember what I've eaten. I hurry, hurry, hurry. I spend my time in very functional offices with very functional furniture, and I never look at the weather or sky or people passing by. I talk, but I don't sing or dance or touch people. I spend the last hour all alone, struggling with crowds, traffic, and parking. Now this same father might also answer, I am a lawyer. I help people and businesses to solve their problems. I help everybody to know the rules that we all have to live by, and to get along according to these rules.